is a war crime. What's happened, and lots of people died.
Yeah, I mean, people are focusing very much on the withdrawal and saying that it's been badly executed, it's botched. Do you think it would have been different, perhaps, had it been completed under Trump, since he agreed to this deal with the Taliban?
It's really hard to speculate on that kind of thing. But how? What did they expect to happen here? And so, you know, the next logical step, in my view, is, did they do it deliberately? Did they want the biggest mess that possibly could occur by simply not doing the necessary planning? It boggles the mind to think they were so dumb, that they didn't get really with it.
So do you think it's this whole campaign has diminished the standing of the U.S. and its allies across the world as military powers, as nation builders, and so forth?
Well, it was avoidable, of course. It was perpetrated for the wrong reasons. Everything is obvious now, so certainly. You know, here's a specific. 6 days ago, on Sunday, there were three Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, okay?
Right.
Three great big Airbus-type things circling Kabul Airport. Now, those of you who have seen the videos saw these little dots all over the runways, and those were people. And so the Germans were circling around. They couldn't land because there were people there, and they didn't want to land on people, right? Okay, now, what does that say? They had to go back. They ran out of fuel. They had to go back to Uzbekistan, refuel and all that. Now, the German people know about that. Yeah? German people don't know that a week before, some German aircraft took what was left of the beer and the spirits that were left in the embassy and other German compounds back to Germany. They repatriated the beer and the spirits.
Ray McGovern, thanks so much for coming on the program. It's great speaking with you.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
So while the United States claimed it had to invade Afghanistan in order to get rid of Al-Qaeda and those who harbored and sheltered it, who helped create Al-Qaeda in the first place? Was it not the U.S. who created Operation Cyclone, with bin Laden and his mentor al-Zawahiri receiving assistance and money from the CIA in order to fight the Soviets? Is the U.S. not supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria right now, now known as HTS, which controls Idlib? Who armed these Salafi terrorists and turned a blind eye to Saudi Arabia's export of Wahhabism? The United States, and even Hillary Clinton, admits this on tape, that the U.S. helped create and fund Al-Qaeda, the same enemy that it claims to be fighting today.
I mean, let's remember here, the people we are fighting today, we funded 20 years ago. And we did it because we were locked in this struggle with the Soviet Union. They invaded Afghanistan, and we did not want to see them control Central Asia, and we went to work. And it was President Reagan, in partnership with the Congress, led by Democrats, who said, you know what, sounds like a pretty good idea. Let's deal with the ISI and the Pakistani military, and let's go recruit these Mujahideen, and let's get some to come from Saudi Arabia and other places, importing their Wahhabi brand of Islam, so that we can go beat the Soviet Union. And guess what? They retreated. They lost billions of dollars, and it led to the collapse of the Soviet Union. So there's a very strong argument, which is, wasn't a bad investment to end the Soviet Union, but let's be careful what we sow, because we will harvest.
So when the Americans and British say that they helped Afghanistan, why are so many people trying to flee then? Why have almost 20,000 people been evacuated in the span of 2 weeks? Was it helping Afghanistan when British and Australian special forces were executing unarmed Afghan men and then planting weapons on their bodies to frame them as terrorists? Was that helping Afghanistan when a video released in 2020 showed Australian SAS chasing an unarmed man, 26-year-old Dad Muhammad, and then executing him in cold blood? We covered these war crimes by Britain and Australia. Here I spoke to whistleblower David McBride, who's facing decades in prison because he helped expose these atrocities. Just a few weeks ago, Daniel Hale was sentenced to 45 months in prison after he blew the whistle on the U.S. drone program, showing, for example, how during a period of 5 months, 90% of the people killed were not even the intended targets. Julian Assange has been persecuted for a decade now and is facing up to 175 years in a U.S. prison because he published the Afghan War Diary, showing how the war was a giant failure in killing scores of civilians. Naturally, you see, there's only negative coverage of the withdrawal, but no negative coverage of this war on terror, or should I say, war of terror. The media loves war. They want to keep people focused on this so-called botched withdrawal, so they don't remember the images of Abu Ghraib or Guantanamo Bay, or the kidnappings, the rendition, and torture. And even more absurd than George Bush and Tony Blair's justification for these wars are people now claiming the U.S. should invade and occupy Afghanistan in the name of women's rights, which they say could be threatened under the Taliban. Now, ironically, these same media liberals and fake anti-war people never say a word about women's rights in Saudi Arabia, a close U.S. ally. The only difference being, of course, that Saudi Arabia gives America enough oil for them to shut up and not care about women's rights. They continue to talk about what to do with Afghanistan and other countries as if they own these countries. They speak like this also about Iran, about Syria, about Iraq, Venezuela, Cuba. This is so indicative of their colonial mentality and worldview. They want to civilize other people because they think they know better. And they don't see other countries as independent sovereign nations that are inhabited by equals. No, they see them as colonies, as vassal states that must be conquered and controlled. They think that they are a force for good when they meddle in other countries' affairs, because deep down, they are neocons. They believe in American exceptionalism. And the West helped create these so-called threats that it claims to fight. And then the West claims it is the only one who can solve these threats through bombs, which is very convenient, of course, for the weapons manufacturers like Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, and the military-industrial complex as a whole, which has made so much money from the invasion of Afghanistan and the so-called war on terror. The United States military budget right now stands at over $752 billion. It is the biggest it's ever been in modern history. And the U.S. not only deploys uniformed troops or conventional armed forces, but also private contractors who far outnumber them and are basically paid mercenaries who get paid 10 times more to do the same jobs as enlisted soldiers. So the contracting firms can basically rip off the taxpayer with even more lucrative deals. Rightfully nicknamed the graveyard of empires, Afghanistan was doomed to fail from day one. Everyone knows this. However, it was certainly not a failure for the arms dealers and private contractors who made a killing, literally made a killing. The entire war was never about nation building or about fighting Al-Qaeda or defeating the Taliban. The United States and Britain invaded Afghanistan based on lies told by George Bush and Tony Blair. They completely fabricated and exaggerated these threats in order to justify the invasions of Afghanistan, Iraq, and other countries. And the only people who benefited from these wars are the arms industry and other private corporations. And if people continue to ignore the truth, if there is no autopsy and detailed critique of the war on terror, then people will learn nothing and will be fooled again in the future. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
According to the Cause of War Project by the Watson Institute at Brown University, the United States spent $2.26 trillion on the war in Afghanistan. That comes to over $300 million spent every single day over the span of two decades. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Mike Mahari, writer. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Government Spent Over $300 Million a Day for 20 Years on Unconstitutional Afghanistan War. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. War is the parent of armies. From these proceed debts and taxes. And armies and debts and taxes are the known instruments for bringing the many under the domination of the few. Taxation not only steals U.S. wealth, it limits freedom. Access to few resources shrinks the number of options available to Americans. The more the U.S. government takes from its people, the more limited their options become. Everybody knows that it costs a lot of money to wage a war, and somebody has to pay for it. The U.S. federal government doesn't have any money of its own. Every dollar it spends eventually has to take from American people, either through direct taxation or the inflation tax, as the Federal Reserve prints money to monetize the national debt. After a 20-year unconstitutional war, the United States pulled troops out of Afghanistan. Within weeks, the Taliban had seized control of the country. How much did this debacle cost? According to the Cost of War Project by the Watson Institute at Brown University, the United States spent $2.26 trillion on the war in Afghanistan. That comes to over $300 million spent every single day over the span of two decades. This includes direct Department of Defense spending for the war totaling $933 billion, State Department outlays for nation building totaling $59 billion, base construction and maintenance cost of $443 billion, money spent caring for Afghanistan veterans totaling $296 billion, and the estimated interest payments for war borrowing totaling $530 billion. And what did Americans get for their $2.26 trillion? Absolutely nothing, and consider the loss of life. According to the cost of war report, between 238,000 and 241,000 people died in Afghanistan over the past two decades as a direct result of the war. That number includes 71,344 civilians, 2,442 U.S. military personnel, and 549 humanitarian aid workers, along with thousands of Afghan military and police personnel. As Madison, American philosopher, said, there are other intangible costs that Americans can't even calculate. They have seen a massive expansion of executive power. In 20 years of pursuing the so-called war on terror, the federal government has trampled the Constitution, ignored the limits on presidential war powers, expanded the surveillance state, claimed the authority to detain Americans on American soil without due process, and heaped piles of additional debt on American people. Not to mention the fact that the U.S. government diverted $2.26 trillion in resources to waging war, money that could have funded economic growth in the private sector. Who knows what the economy could have produced had all of that money not been funneled into making bombs and killing people over the world. On top of all of this, pile on the social cost, or as Madison put it, the degeneracy of manners and morals. When you add up all the costs, the final sum is a loss of liberty. Madison summed it up, no nation could preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare. You can't have limited government and perpetual war. The founders understood this and created a system that would make it difficult to drag the United States into military entanglements. Having unfettered itself from its constitutional restraints, war has become the default position for the U.S. government, and Americans have all paid the price. These undeclared wars have cost countless lives, trillions of dollars in treasure, and have eroded American people's liberties at home, just as James Madison predicted.
The world with reporters.
A scene of desperation transformed into one of horror in the waning days of the U.S.-led occupation. Two terrorist attacks on Kabul airport, claimed by Daesh. Dozens killed, among them children and U.S. troops. Hundreds more injured. British troops were spared this time. The U.K. Prime Minister says is sticking to the evacuation plans.
The military, the Foreign Office teams, the Home Office, the Border Force teams are there getting people through as fast as they can still. And we're going to keep going up until the last moment.
That last moment comes on August 31st. Thousands, including British troops and eligible Afghans, are yet to be evacuated. And the threat of more attacks is looming. Pressure on the government over its handling of the crisis is mounting.
The Foreign Secretary shouts now, but he stayed on holiday while our mission in Afghanistan was disintegrating. You cannot coordinate an international response from the beach.
It's a shambolic end to a 20-year-long U.S.-led occupation, leaving ordinary Afghans to fend for themselves in a country torn by decades of war.
They invaded on a pretext, which was a false pretext, and then for 20 years they've spent $2 to $3 trillion destroying that country. The future in that regard is tough for the Afghani people. They're starting from a very low base as one of the poorest countries on earth, but there are resourceful, ingenious people, who are well capable of lifting themselves out of their current situation.
The UK followed the US and their NATO allies into Afghanistan in 2001, purportedly to topple the Taliban, only to hand the country back to the militant group two decades later.
Imperialism invades for reasons of extraction of material wealth, to dominate markets, to dominate labor, to dominate resources. They had a geostrategic policy to dominate the oil of that region. Forget their talk about green energy. They want to extract the maximum fossil fuels from the Middle East and dominate every government, any government which stands in their way and is non-compliant.
The Kabul airport attacks will probably not be the last ones. A taste of what to expect in post-occupation Afghanistan.
Experts say what's happening in Afghanistan right now is another crisis created by an illegal war waged by the U.S., the U.K., and other NATO countries. Another example that military invasion or intervention is not conducive to stability or lasting peace. Saeed Pariza, London.
Turkey still seems to be undecided over the issue of the Kabul airport. The Turkish president said Ankara is still yet to decide on a request by the Taliban to run the airport. This came in a presser held in Atatürk Airport ahead of a trip the president is taking to Sarajevo. After Turkey's decision to withdraw troops located at the Kabul airport, the Taliban asked Turkey's assistance in operating the airport. Ankara says it isn't against the idea. However, there are certain things that the Taliban should provide first, such as securing the airport, especially after the latest bombing that took place on Thursday.
The Taliban have made a request regarding the operation of Kabul airport. They say we'll ensure security and you can operate it. But we have not made a decision yet because there's always the possibility of death and such things there.
Turkish president said the hesitation is due to several factors. The main one is the current power vacuum, assuring that a decision will be made once a new government is formed, and security is prevailed in Afghanistan. He added that commercial flights to Kabul will not be resumed now. Turkey urged the Taliban earlier to form an inclusive government, which includes former Afghan leaders. Ankara said those politicians have a certain credibility internationally and would help in ensuring political stability. Turkey is currently working to evacuate its citizens from Afghanistan. However, it seems that Ankara plans to accept Taliban's offer to run the airport, assuring that it is very important to keep the airport functioning to help receive aid supplies. Rahşan Saglam, Istanbul.
The Italian government is considering further expanding its Green Pass scheme, which is part of a plan that aims to have 80% of its citizens vaccinated against the pandemic by the end of September. Despite a significant recent slowdown in the vaccination rate, about 60% of the population has received both doses of COVID-19 vaccine in Italy so far. The government is now considering making it a requirement for employees to show proof of vaccination, testing or recovery at workplaces, including public offices and supermarkets.
La Sicilia, al primo, all'ultimo...
Mind you, the Sicily region, which has the lowest number of vaccinated people, could soon be classified as a high-risk red zone. The vast majority of those in intensive care units these days have not been vaccinated, and the Green Pass scheme serves the purpose of changing their mind.
Italy's Prime Minister Mario Draghi has repeatedly said that the use of the Green Pass scheme is the only alternative to a new lockdown. However, a conspicuous number of Italians are opposing the government's anti-COVID rules that they say infringe on their civil liberties.
Many in Italy are not willing to get vaccinated and are against the mandatory anti-COVID Green Pass. Earlier this month, protests were held in several Italian cities against the introduction of new measures requiring proof of vaccination.
L'essere umano è così, non siamo mai tutti.
That's how people are made. We cannot agree on everything, but the vaccine and the Green Pass is the way to go.
Basta queste scuse.
Enough with excuses. We are not kids. Maybe our authorities should be more severe with those who refuse to get vaccinated.
Since August 6, the Green Pass has been required in order to enter cultural and leisure venues across Italy. From September the 1st, the pass will also be a requirement for all teachers and other school staff. However, the National Association of Head Teachers warned on Wednesday that schools are not equipped to check all the students' vaccine passports. Max Civili, Rome.
Representative of the World Health Organization to the Islamic Republic of Iran, Dr. Jafar Hussain, has visited one of the main vaccination centers in capital Tehran to closely monitor the process of vaccination. In a country where the Delta variant of the coronavirus is killing almost 700 people on a daily basis. During his visit, he learned about different phases of the process, both before and after the vaccination. The WHO representative said that despite sanctions and economic problems, Iran is among countries which has already paid for vaccines from COVAX, but the delivery of the vaccines has been delayed for different reasons.
Iran is a country which has paid already for 16.8 million doses from COVAX, already paid with all the economic sanctions, everything it is facing. The problem is that because of the major outbreaks in other part of the world, like India, like Brazil and other, the vaccine availability globally reduced. What our Director General is recommending to every country head of the state, that it is a whole of society, whole of government approach to control COVID. Not only government can do it, not only WHO can do it, not only other UN, not only private, everybody has to join hand.
The number of outpatients with COVID-19 has decreased by almost 2% this week. We anticipate that the number of hospitalizations will even come down next week.
Iran's death toll from COVID-19 has exceeded 100,000. The rapid rise in COVID-19 cases and deaths in the past weeks has prompted Iranian officials to make utmost efforts to import more vaccines and accelerate the vaccination pace.
According to official reports, almost 10% of the Iranian population have already received two jabs of the COVID-19 vaccines. Experts say the pace is too slow. Accordingly, the new Iranian government has vowed to take all necessary measures to accelerate the vaccination pace and manage the pandemic as soon as possible. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
In its latest saber-rattling against Iran, Israel has said it may have to resort to military action against the Islamic Republic. Israeli Minister of Military Affairs Benny Gantz made the threat, accusing Iran of seeking to build a nuclear weapon. He said military action must be considered as a plan B to prevent Iran from accessing the materials for a nuke. Meanwhile, the chief of the staff of the Israeli military made a similar threat, saying the regime is speeding up its, quote, operational plans against Iran. He also noted that Israel has recently approved a military budget to expand its capabilities against the Islamic Republic. Israel's blatant confessions of its warmongering policies come as it points to recent increases in uranium enrichment as evidence that Iran is racing toward producing a bomb. Israel has been alleging that Iran is trying to build nuclear weapons since the 1980s, but it has failed to produce any evidence to support its claims.
Israeli aggression and attack against the Islamic Republic of Iran will be a matter of the existence of the Zionist entity. They are trying to bother from one time to time by cyber, digital, electronic warfare, but Iran is proven its capability of equality and competition among superpowers in this field.
Iran, on the other hand, has pledged that any aggression against it will be met with a decisive response regardless of where it comes from.
No one in Iran takes this seriously. The Israeli regime has just ended a major catastrophic loss in its conflict with the Palestinian people. So when the Israelis cannot defeat a Palestinian people who are surrounded in a concentration camp called Gaza, then the Israeli regime is in no position to talk about military confrontation with Iran.
Moreover, Iranian officials have on many occasions stressed that Tehran does not want a war, but that Iran will give a crushing response to aggressors. Israel says it wants to prevent Iran from obtaining nuclear arms, while Tel Aviv remains the only possessor of nuclear weapons in the region. In 2008, former U.S. President Jimmy Carter said Israel holds at least 150 nuclear weapons. It was the first time a U.S. president publicly acknowledged Israel's atomic arsenal.
Suicide bombers set off two blasts in Afghanistan's capital, Kabul, on Thursday. The bombings took place outside Hamid Karzai International Airport as thousands were awaiting evacuations following a Taliban takeover of Kabul. Casualties included Afghan civilians and American forces. The U.S. troops suffered their heaviest casualty toll in a single incident in Afghanistan since 2011. In response, President Joe Biden promised punishment for the perpetrators. Biden, under enormous pressure over his administration's handling of the Afghan crisis, said the airlift would continue.
We will not forgive. We will not forget. We will hunt you down and make you pay. We will not be deterred by terrorists. We will not let them stop our mission. We will continue the evacuation.
More than 100,000 people have been flown out of Afghanistan since the Taliban swept into power on August 15. The Taliban had allowed the U.S.-led forces to conduct the airlift while planning to finalize their own government as soon as the American troops left. U.S. forces are racing to complete their withdrawal from Afghanistan by an August 31 deadline set by President Biden. His administration is facing growing criticism over the situation in Afghanistan and what is seen as a hasty withdrawal after two decades of military presence. Biden, however, says the U.S. has long ago achieved its original rationale for invading Afghanistan in 2001, to root out al-Qaeda militants and prevent a repeat of the September 11 attacks on the United States. Analysts believe the U.S. has failed to achieve any of its objectives.
Despite spending $200 million per day over the past 20 years, accumulating well in excess of some $2-3 trillion of U.S. taxpayer money, despite sending hundreds of thousands of U.S. troops, our youth, our sisters and brothers who are now traumatized, some lost life and limb, U.S. imperialism has very clearly lost. They've been kicked out by an indigenous resistance.
The U.S. invaded Afghanistan with the stated goal of toppling the Taliban and improving security there. 20 years on, nothing has changed on the ground except the death of tens of thousands of innocent civilians. That, along with the current chaotic pullout, has more than ever raised questions on Washington's real intention about its Afghanistan operation.
After 5 days of marathon debates in Parliament over the credentials of President Raisi's cabinet choices, the final voting was held. All but one of the 19 proposed ministers won the Parliament's confidence. Parliament gave no confidence to Hossein Barghouti, the proposed education minister. With 76 votes in favor, 193 against, and 18 abstentions. In his address to Parliament, President Raisi said his cabinet will start its work as soon as the following day. He says he will not waste an hour to solve the country's problems.
After the vote of confidence is over, we will kickstart our activities with the new cabinet as of tomorrow. Our country is grappling with serious issues, and we must not waste even an hour to address them. Issues such as the fight against the coronavirus and the need to speed up nationwide vaccination will be on top of our agenda.
The ministers of defense, foreign affairs, and intelligence were among the nominees with the highest votes. Lawmakers say this signals that Parliament shares the same approach with the government over foreign policy and national security.
This is meaningful. It shows that Parliament will support the plans of the new ministers. And as the President says, the new cabinet will work throughout the day to solve the problems of the country.
Ebrahim Raisi handed his proposed cabinet lineup to Parliament 2 weeks ago, a week after he took the oath of office as Iran's new president. Legislators then started reviewing the credentials of the proposed ministers behind closed doors for a week, and in the open sessions for the past 5 days. With just one nominee dropping out of the list,
It seems that the new government will not face serious friction with Parliament in its job. Raisi now has 3 months to introduce a new name for education minister. And until then, a caretaker will be appointed to run the ministry. Yusuf Jalali from Iran's Parliament.
Thousands of Palestinians were injured in a protest east of the city of Khan Yunis in the Gaza Strip, where Israeli army fired live bullets and tear gas on protesters who came calling for an end to the blockade imposed by Israel. The mass protest organized by Islamic and national forces comes as a part of the popular resistance activities that demands giving Palestinians their rights and allow the reconstruction of the Gaza Strip after the latest escalation.
Palestinians came here to stress the importance of the popular resistance with all means. They also demanded their human rights and called for an end to the blockade imposed for 15 years now. Palestinians are only calling for their rights to live with dignity. Israeli regime should be aware that the resistance will support its people and it will force the Israeli regime to accept the Palestinians' demands.
Palestinian factions warned the Israeli regime in a press conference during the rally that they won't accept any delay in the reconstruction process and ending of the crippling siege imposed for 15 years that provoked Palestinians' anger, stressing that the Israeli policies won't break the Palestinian willingness.
The Israeli crimes against Palestinians have led them to come here to voice their anger. The Israeli regime must end the blockade and the Gaza Strip. Palestinians will keep to resist against the occupation regime.
Earlier, Palestinians held a similar protest where an Israeli soldier was critically injured and dozens of Palestinians were shot in clashes with the Israeli army. These protests held by Palestinians aim to expose the Israeli crimes amid the silence of the international community.
We call for an end to this suffocating blockade that has deteriorated our lives. This protest aims to find a way out of our misery. This condition is unacceptable. International community must give Israel a punishment for its crimes here.
Tensions along the separation fence are still ongoing as Palestinian protesters here came to express their refusal of the Israeli blockade and demand allowing the reconstruction of Gaza following an 11-day escalation. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
A special relationship. A term coined after the Second World War by then-British Prime Minister Winston Churchill to describe his country's close bilateral ties with former colony the U.S., from economic to cultural to military. Decades later, that supposed strong bond seems to exist in all but name.
It was never special. We already discussed the Suez Crisis where the U.S., you know, basically told Britain to get out of the way, slapped it aside like a little child, a recalcitrant child. Tony Blair was the last British Prime Minister who really put a lot of political capital into this so-called special relationship. The price has been thousands of British soldiers killed, over 457 in Afghanistan alone.
Successive U.S. presidents have dealt serious blows to this transatlantic alliance, from Ronald Reagan, who ordered the invasion of Grenada, a Commonwealth country, when Margaret Thatcher was at number 10, the supposed acme of the special relationship, all the way to Trump and now Biden, who ordered the Afghanistan pullout without consulting the UK.
It gives lie to the idea that there ever was a special relationship. It only existed in the deluded minds of British mandarins and British political elites because they felt they still wanted to feel that Britain was a great power and that they, even though they didn't have an empire, they still retain an empire state of mind. And that is now being blown right out the water with the fall of Afghanistan.
In a sign of heightened tensions, the reaction from a man who got the UK involved in US-led wars in Afghanistan and later Iraq, and is a great believer in this special relationship. He has called Biden's decision imbecilic.
A policy can't be decided by slogan. It's got to be decided on the basis of a strategy, and that's a different thing. And that's really the purpose of what I was saying.
With or without a strategy, it's happening. As U.S. troops evacuate defeated, so must their British peers, just as they went into the country in September 2001. The Taliban have ruled out any extension of the occupation.
If they are intent on continuing the occupation, so it will provoke a reaction.
The exit from Afghanistan is a chaotic one, and the fury at number 10 over being ignored and humiliated is palpable, offering a window into the state of the UK-US relations.
Theirs is a special relationship perennially skewed in Washington's favor, and where junior partner, the UK, plays the role of obedient sidekick. Said Pourreza, London.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Zainab, peace be upon her, played unparalleled role on the way to Karbala with Imam Hussein on the day of Ashura with all those hardships and after Imam Hussein had been martyred. It is impossible to find a similar figure in history. Later on, numerous events took place during her captivity in Kufa and in Sham. Because of these great selfless efforts, Zainab al-Kubra gained a prominent position before Allah the Exalted. And this is something that we cannot describe. In the Holy Quran, Allah the Exalted mentions the names of two women as perfect examples of faith. God also mentions the names of two women as examples of infidelity. Allah sets forth for an example to the unbelievers, the wife of Noah and the wife of Lut. They were respectively under two of our righteous servants. The Holy Quran, chapter 66, verse 10. These two women exemplify infidelity. That is to say, Allah the Exalted mentions women, not men, as examples of both infidelity and faith. And Allah sets forth as an example to those who believe the wife of Pharaoh. The Holy Quran, chapter 66, verse number 11.
Ana mazlum Hussein.
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
He mentions the wife of Pharaoh and Mary as two perfect examples of faith. And Mary, the daughter of Imran, the Holy Quran, chapter 66, verse number 12. A brief comparison between Zainab al-Kubra and the wife of Pharaoh would show the greatness of Zainab al-Kubra's position. In the Holy Quran, the wife of Pharaoh has been recognized as the example of faith for both men and women until the end of time. But just compare the wife of Pharaoh, who had faith in Moses' prophethood and had been enchanted by his guidance, with Zainab al-Kubra, when she was tortured by Pharaoh. According to narrations and historical texts, she passed away due to the torture she suffered. She was frustrated by the physical pain. She said, "O my Lord, build for me, in nearness to you, a mansion in the garden, and save me from Pharaoh and his doings." The Holy Quran, chapter 66, verse number 11. In fact, she was praying for her death, "and save me from Pharaoh and his doings." This was while her problem was only the physical torture. Unlike Zainab al-Kubra, she had not suffered the loss of several brothers, two children, and many of her relatives and nephews. She had not watched her dear ones go to the battlefield where they were supposed to be killed.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we witnessed that abuse by law enforcement officers in the United States is one of the most serious and divisive human rights violations in the country, as U.S. police is killing black people at persistently high rates. What is clear is that racism is at the very heart of the issue, as statistics show that black people are three times more likely to be killed by police than white people. What is worse is that even black children are being targeted. Yet the people have not been silent. They have organized in what is known as the Black Lives Matter campaign to get the message across that all lives are of equal value, no matter the color of the skin. Stay with us for the rest of the program.
We're just going over some things for the vigil. It's going to be in Nicholas Hayward Jr. Park. That's in Brooklyn. He was murdered by the police, 13-year-old murdered by the police, for like really similar circumstances, very close parallel to what was happening with what happened with Tamir Rice. So it's important for me, I think, that that place be chosen and that his story be highlighted. So to that end, I'm always trying to connect the dots so that people see, yes, this is a national issue, but this is also a local issue. So his father's going to be speaking. We'll have a prayer by Pastor Omar, words from Mr. Hayward, and then I'll close out talking about the national epidemic of police violence against children. And this is why I wanted us to meet, so that we could talk about things that I may be overlooking. Well, for one, I've applied for a permit with the Parks Department. You guys know that's always important to me, but I also wanted to get your input on that. We had issues with the permit with the march, lots of fighting. with the parks department and the police department. And so they haven't been responsive yet, so I'm wondering if we're going to encounter the same issues that we did with the 4 Mile March. The reason why I choose places of public accommodation is because we have a legal right to be there. And so, like, you know, there's nothing that they can really do about us exercising our First Amendment right within the space of public accommodation. I'm really glad that the weather held up.
Thank God, because yesterday was terrible.
Yeah, I thought it was going to rain.
Imagine if yesterday would have been today.
Probably. Yeah, and lugging all of this stuff in the rain, and I know it would have been a terrible turnout. But
get ponchos.
Yeah. Exactly. But, you know, people don't show up when it's rainy or cold, so I'm really glad that people have, you know, I think we're going to have a good turnout.
So I'm really excited working with Leah because, you know, you saw her. She's going to be having the weatherproof posters of the children and their stories.
She did a great job.
Yeah. I think that'll be powerful with it tied, like, on the fence so that passerbys, you know, will wonder and come and look, and then they can read the stories.
Yeah, I'm excited about that. She also did an art installation on the floor where she got age-appropriate shoes, like the whatever size of shoe size would be at the age that they were killed, and she painted those white, and those are going to be there too. So it's going to really help you visualize how small these kids were when their lives were stolen.
And I think it's good to focus on the children because this is something that can't be argued. Like,
exactly.
Even you can play devil's advocate, but these are children.
Exactly.
Children are harmless, so.
Tamir Wright, 12 years old, playing with a toy gun in the park. The cops roll up on him, and in 2 seconds, they have killed him. 1001, 1002, Tamir is dead. And this is not an isolated incident. It happens all too often, and it must stop.
In September 1994, Nicholas Hayward Jr. was shot and killed in a public housing stairwell by an NYPD officer who mistook a plastic toy gun for a real one. Hayward was just 13 years old. Like so many other cases, no one was indicted in connection with the killing. In the 22 years since Hayward's death, his father has struggled with how and why his son died.
I cry a lot. It's hard to deal with losing a loved one. Nicholas was 13 years old. It pains me every time I hear of another victim being killed. My son was a great kid. He wasn't causing any harm to anyone. He was doing the right things. You know, he wasn't a danger or a threat to the officer that killed him. So, I mean, I feel that it's just something that I have to do. I have to do this. We live in a society that continues to criminalize our youth, despite the fact how much effort they put forward to try to make their own life better. My son was doing the best that he can prior to him being killed. And he told the officer, we're only playing. And he shot and killed Nicholas in mid-sentence. And despite all of the witnesses who basically justified what Nicholas was doing, that he dropped the toy gun. They all told the district attorney he dropped the toy gun and the officer shot him anyway.
I think that actually there is a culture in police departments to protect each other so that when they engage in the use of arbitrary power, they come together, the code of silence, and refuse to allow us to find out exactly what goes on. I think they also have intimate connections to the judges and others. But I would say this, though, there's no doubt in my mind that there was an epidemic of shooting of precious, well-to-do white brothers and sisters. Police would be accountable. So even given the culture of the police departments that make it difficult for accountability to take place, it's also the fact that when it comes to poor black and brown peoples, that their lives matter less than the lives of well-to-do whites. And therefore, we have to make sure that there's fair policing rather than arbitrary policing. I think fair policing is police having a relationship with the community in which they're an organic part of that community. They are fighting crime. There's all kinds of forms of criminality, including criminality in the black community, criminality in Wall Street, criminality in professional circles and so forth. But police, unfortunately, over the years, have engaged in such massive arbitrary uses of power that the distrust cuts very, very deep. And of course, it's the backdrop of wealth inequality. It's a backdrop of a capitalist system that makes it very difficult for working peoples of any color to have their humanity affirmed. It's the backdrop of a system in which the opportunities are so limited, the decrepit school system, the massive unemployment, as well as massive underemployment. So we can't overlook the larger social context of the policing that goes on in America. But it can be much more fair than it is now.
A state of emergency has been declared in the U.S. city of Baltimore after protesters clashed with police. It follows the funeral of Freddie Gray, who died in police custody over a week ago. The National Guard say that as many as 5,000 troops have been deployed amid the unrest.
Basically, since Monday, there's been a lot of speculation about what's going on out there, but basically, Freddie Gray, as we remember, we don't know why he was arrested, but he was stopped and he was arrested. And under police custody, his spine ended up being broken, and he died from his injuries. So we just need to figure out what's going on, because there's a lot of things being said. We don't know if the youth, we don't know what's going on. We know that a CVS was destroyed. But, I mean, with the state of the Baltimore that I knew, I don't imagine that it could be much different from how it used to be. So I am going to head out there, see what's going on, see what I can learn from it, see how I can help, how I can support, but I just can't stay here in New York and not do anything at this point. So I'm heading out there.
Breaking news from Baltimore, a city on edge since the death of a suspect while in police custody, his spine nearly severed. Tonight, those tensions fueling violent protests now. Dramatic images coming in at this hour. You can see some people on the streets there throwing rocks and bricks at police officers.
On April 19th, 2015, 23-year-old Freddie Gray Jr., an African-American man, died in a Baltimore hospital after sustaining injuries while being transported in a police van. Gray had been arrested a week before by the Baltimore Police Department for possessing what the police said was an illegal switchblade. Gray's hospitalization and subsequent death resulted in an ongoing series of protests. On April 25th, 2015, a major protest in downtown Baltimore turned violent, resulting in 34 arrests and injuries to 15 police officers. After Gray's funeral on April 27th, civil disorder intensified with the looting and burning of local businesses and a drugstore, resulting in a state of emergency declared by Maryland Governor Larry Hogan. The Maryland National Guard was deployed to Baltimore, and a curfew was put into place.
I went there expecting the worst because I had seen the National Guard on TV and I had seen like how occupied they were by the military. So I was a little nervous when I got there, but surprisingly, it seemed that they were protecting mostly the harbor, the downtown harbor. That's where all of the National Guard really was, and it seemed that that was what their attention was focused on protecting. I think the media tried to kind of instill fear so that the same thing wouldn't happen in New York. But with Baltimore, it was the young children not feeling heard. It was mostly young children. All of the programs out there are cut for them. There's really nothing for them after school or part-time job-wise out there. So these children, they felt unheard, and their thing was to take to the streets. They were emotional. They started destroying, you know, things that they didn't feel were beneficial to the community.
The narrative around Baltimore, first of all, was that it was a riot. And I don't like that terminology because it's an uprising. It's cause and effect. When people are living in pervasive poverty, in homelessness, in joblessness,
And on top of that, you add to that the current political climate where we see, not that it wasn't happening before, but where we see an overabundance of cops shooting and killing unarmed men, that was a natural response to those conditions. As with every other protest that has happened throughout this country in response to this issue, there was a negative slant put on it. They wanted to paint these people.